sometimes young CEOs don't know what they don't know, and they're not very willing to acknowledge it, right? The entrepreneurial world, how often do we see stories about a founder that ends up getting in the way of the success of a company, right? Because he or she doesn't want to give anything away, wants to assume all control. And it's a tragedy because those founders would be the single biggest beneficiaries of success.
Right.
So why not bring a team around you that increases the probability of that success?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Winotto, and I'm the director of the UCSF Rosamond Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. Today, we're talking to Joe Mandato, who is an investor and also innovator. He is managing director of De Novo Ventures, an advisor and board director for many startups, and he also co-teaches the medical device innovation course at Stanford. As you will hear, Joe has done many, many impressive things. He was a captain in the U.S. Army Medical Service Corps and participated as staff member of the President Nixon Inaugural Committee before beginning a career in medical technology. Over the next 12 years, he led five companies to successful growth and acquisitions. His leadership experience has taught him a lot that you will be able to apply to your own startup or program. In particular, you'll hear why it matters who you have on your board, and not just whether they are famous people, but exactly what skills and experience they have. This episode is packed with insight, and we hope you enjoy the talk. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And one more thing, are you a founder of a health technology startup looking for an industry partner or seeking funding from seed to Series A? Apply to the 2020 Rosamond Innovators by Tuesday, April 14. Applications are open on February 18 and details on our website at rosamondinstitute.org.
So my first introduction to healthcare happened when I was a young soldier in the Army. I was a young enlisted person. I had a choice of my military occupational specialty, and I chose to be a medic. And I went through the training at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and I received my first assignment to be a medic in Vietnam. Well, the average life cycle of a medic in Vietnam was not very long. And as I was standing there in line, an officer approached me and asked if I'd be interested in becoming an officer. Absolutely. Of course. Yes. Immediately. And so I went through that school, and I was sent to Washington, D.C. on my first assignment. It was going to be at the Pentagon. I was sitting in the chair waiting for my new boss to show up. He showed up and he said, before you get settled, there's a new general being appointed to take over Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And we'd like you to go up and be interviewed to be his aide-de-camp. I said, great. My career, I mean, this is, you know, lots of things going on. So I went up there and he offered me the position, and it was exciting. He was a wonderful man. He was a thoracic surgeon by training. I really, really loved him, almost as a surrogate dad, and he did the same for me, and I learned a tremendous amount from him. So it was a very, very satisfying relationship. It went on for 3 years. I walked the hospital wards with him. We learned so much. I learned so much from him. It was a precious relationship, and that was my introduction to healthcare. And I knew I wanted to stay, but I also knew I wanted to stay, perhaps as an executive.
Not a doctor.
Not a doctor. That would have been nice, but not a doctor. Right. Next lifetime. Right. Next lifetime. So it was very good. It was a very good experience and a very, very wonderful relationship.
Yeah.
His friend at the time, another general, General Takash, was the president's personal physician. And so he asked if I would be interested in going and being interviewed at the White House and seeing if there was something to do there. Uh-huh. And so I did. Uh-huh. So I moved to Washington, and I did get a position at the bottom rung of the ladder. But
at the White House.
It was pretty interesting.
So what was it like to be in the White House?
Well, as a young person, it was pretty exciting, right? And no matter what you did, and I was a so-called advance man. When the president would go somewhere, I would go first with other people, and we'd set up White House communications. We'd coordinate with the Secret Service and the travel office, blah, 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 blah. It was pretty extraordinary. It was pretty extraordinary. And it was a wonderful job.
What did it teach you?
So assuming responsibility, big time, and accountability.
Yeah.
There was no room for error. It was very interesting. And so you became very conscientious, and you made sure you got the job done, and you made sure you got it right, and you didn't need to talk about it very much. You were just, a cog in the wheel,
okay,
if you will.
Did it teach you a little bit on a process on how to, because there's so much to do.
Right.
And how do you organize?
Actually that's a great question, because on the contrary, it did not spend a lot of time thinking about process. It spent a lot of time infusing you with the will to get something done at all cost.
That comes in very handy.
Very interesting, right? I mean, they were expecting you to move mountains, and sometimes that was really hard to do. And you had to figure out what may be a good backup, right? Or what resources could you take advantage of to help you move a mountain, right?
Well, do you have any recollection of what would that mountain is?
Right. So I think it was when the Republican convention was going on in Miami, I was tasked with going down there and being responsible for the president's arrival at the airport, right, in Air Force One. And the Secret Service wanted to do one way. White House Communications wanted to do it another way. And I was proposing a different way. And I had no leverage. I had no leverage whatsoever. I had no authority. I was not wearing any rank on my shoulder. I had to figure a way to convince them that it was the right thing to do. And somehow it was the right thing to do, and we got it done. It was fascinating education.
Yeah. And how long were you there for?
I was there for a year.
Okay. Well, that's, you must have learned a lot within that year.
I learned a lot. And then I received a political appointment in the government after the election was over.
And how do you make that transition from being in the government and then move to the private sector?
Yeah. That's a great question. And so I knew that the government was just a short, brief, highly educational experience, and that you reach a point of diminishing returns fairly quickly. The good news is my assignment subsequent to the White House was in something called the Bureau of East-West Trade. And this bureau helped American businesses develop trade relationships around the world. And this particular focus was on Eastern Europe. I had a master's degree, and my focus was on Eastern European affairs. So I would travel to Poland, Russia, Bulgaria, all over, and at the government expense. And again, it was a great learning experience. So my transition was a very reasonable one in that I had expertise in doing business overseas. So new young companies always needed somebody with international experience. Very few American companies start out very early in doing things overseas. And so I was picked up by one of those companies that happened to be in ophthalmic ultrasound. And I was responsible for their international marketing and sales. And so my first trip was to Tehran, Iran, where we had no business, but I had to figure a way to develop business. My second trip was to Damascus, Syria, many years ago.
All the places that now
is... Again, you know, I mean, Damascus is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world, and it hasn't changed much since day one. I mean, it was like going back in time, but it was, again, a fascinating experience that other people didn't want to do. They didn't want to do it. I wanted to do it. So that was all great learning. So I spent several years with Sonometric Systems, which became part of Rohrer Group, R-O-R-E-R. Rohrer made Malox. But they also had a medical device and instrumentation division, and Sonometrics was part of that. Mm. So we were merged with a company called Silco. Silco was another division of Rohrer, and they made intraocular lens implants. And so my international experience, they decided it would be great if I'd be willing to go to Europe and spend several years opening a Europe, Middle East, Africa headquarters. And I could go and decide where you want to put it. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a great idea.
That must be fun because you got to choose where you want to be.
Incredible. So we went to a town called Zug, Z-U-G, which is a canton in Switzerland, just 24 kilometers outside of Zurich.
Okay.
It was a town of 7,000 people on a lake with 19,000 foreign companies registered there because it was a low-tax canton. And so the data was so compelling, that's where we should establish our headquarters. So I opened an office in Switzerland.
Not a bad place.
It was a great place. And I was responsible for everything in Europe, Middle East, Africa. We had distributors. We had direct sales forces. We had subsidiaries, blah, 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 blah. But it was a lot of travel. Wonderful travel. Mm-hmm. Fabulous travel. It turns out one of the divisions had an office in Cannes, which there's no legitimacy for us having an office in Cannes.
Beautiful place,
though. It's a beautiful place. But we ended up closing that office in Cannes. So that was a great experience. Mm-hmm. And then I took over responsibility for domestic and international for this company. And then I was approached while we were in Europe for another company located in Southern California, a company called Ioptics Research. Mm-hmm. And that was in ophthalmology. It developed and manufactured intraocular lenses. And it was the 12th entrant in the industry. Mm. And so I took over as their chief operating officer. Because the CEO, the founder, was living up in San Francisco. The company was in Los Angeles. And the CEO was kind of sort of a senior salesperson. So they needed somebody with deeper and broader experience and to back up that person. While we were on a roadshow in Europe, the company was going to go public, the CEO left the company. Bankers have said we've had CEOs die on roadshows. We've had CEOs, you know, not do very well on roadshows. We've never had somebody voluntarily leave the company during the roadshow. And so the founder, Ken, said, "Joe, you have to step in, be CEO." Ken, you haven't made an offer yet. You're right. You haven't made an offer yet. So we spent several years building the company. Because we were the 12th entrant, we had to figure a different way to build a company. People weren't, you know, when you assess what the customer really needs, right? Sometimes it's not features or benefits or a lower price. Sometimes it's something different. And we figured out that the clinicians were, in fact, individual business owners. And they needed somebody they could talk to help manage their business. And so our salespeople were almost they were so-called value-add salespeople. They were people, mature people, sophisticated people, that the clinicians could talk to and get advice on how best to manage their little practice, or perhaps to grow their practice, or to make their practice more efficient, or to make their practice more friendly. So we would have a salesperson go in and suggest to the physician that the staff wear name tags. They all put on a little uniform. They ordered new magazines instead of having 1 or 2 year old magazines in there.
But your company is not doing that.
Yes, they're giving the advice. Mm-hmm. They're only providing the expertise.
Okay.
And that was a huge value add. Mm-hmm. And so, we just had a very intelligent consultative sales force, mm-hmm. and that made us different than anybody else out there.
And become a resource for this.
But we were a huge resource. We were a friend. And their practice would just grow as a result. And we grew as a result. And so we went from number 12 in market share to number 4 in market share.
Did you abandon the whole IPO plan?
Yes. We did an LBO. So we were on the roadshow. And we were somewhere over Texas, and the market fell precipitously. And so the old IPO market cooled dramatically, Ken decided to pull it, all right? And we went out and see if we could find an alternative. And yes, we were able to organize an alternative with this fellow Bob Stockman in Princeton, New Jersey, and we organized this LPO. Ken was still involved till he would never let go.
Ken is the founder.
Yes. And I stayed on as the CEO. And we implemented this program, this strategy, which was highly differentiated. We segmented the market. We understood what was our most immediate addressable market, and that was the young, ambitious clinician that wanted to grow his or her practice. And we developed relationships which were very tight, very enduring, and were good for both the clinician, the patients, and us, right? Mm-hmm. So that was, we ended up being bought by a British healthcare company.
Smith & Nephew.
And yeah. And I understood why there was an American Revolution. All my direct reports dotted lines to their U.S. headquarters, their British headquarters. Everyone. I mean, it took the culture that we had established that was really successful, and they wanted us to be like them, even though we were, 15% of their revenues in the United States, but 25% of the U.S. profits. And yet they wanted us to learn how to be like them, and that didn't work very well.
Yeah. I think nowadays there's a lot of stories where a company, when they got acquired, they want them to stay intact, their culture, maintaining their...
They talk about it. But it's very, very difficult for them to actually execute on, mm-hmm. on that strategy, right? And you've got so many examples where post-acquisition, the growth seems to slow, people leave. It's just not the same. Mm-hmm. And the large caps, the large companies, don't seem to know how to work around it.
Yeah.
Right? It's very interesting.
So that's your first CEO gig, and you had a good success.
It was a great success.
This first one
was in Europe, but mm-hmm. this was the one where I was involved,
you kind of,
in an owner,
yeah,
if you will.
It's almost like, oh.
Yeah.
One after another.
Yeah. It was a great experience.
Yeah. Do you take time off to at least like relax a little bit before
yes.
you...
Yes.
So how about the next gig?
I went to one of these, executive courses at Northwestern. I spent 6 weeks at Kellogg, which was fabulous. And I received a call from a headhunter about a small company in San Francisco looking for a CEO. And I was intrigued because I love San Francisco. I wanted to be in San Francisco. My family was good with moving to San Francisco. So I went and had an interview. And this is really interesting. So I had a success. I had options. And I had an interview with this company where I'm going to describe the four founders. One was Fred Moll, right? So, you know, the King Kong of innovation and robotics. Jay Watkins, a brilliant young guy, a Harvard MBA, a wonderful person. Al Chin, who was a partner of Fogarty early on, who got his degree from MIT in engineering, went into aerospace, and then decided to go to medical school.
He did it here at UCSF.
Yeah. And Milt McCall, who was an academic All-American football player at Stanford, went and played for the 49ers for 8 years, and got his medical degree from Stanford in the off-season, right? Why would I want to go to work with these guys, right? What can I offer them, right? But it became an offer. I agreed to it, and it was the most extraordinary experience I've ever had. A leader is supposed to be a teacher, right? Mm-hmm. I had four guys that could teach me about so many different things, right? And the reciprocity between us, amongst us, was so extraordinary, right? There were some things I could do well, but there were lots of things they could do well. So it was mutually beneficial. It was a wonderful experience. And they're all friends today, which
right.
I think is also extraordinary when all the founders last.
Yeah.
With the CEO. With
was
the
it like
CEO.
Love at the first sight? Or
I wouldn't go that far. But, we all had different ways of doing things. My first day, I always show up really early, right? So I was the first one at work. And I received a call from a physician in an operating room somewhere in the Midwest on how to operate this instrument that we provided him. I had no clue. I mean, it was one of our instruments was used for in hip revisions, right? It was a cement remover, right? Which is a very difficult thing to do under the best of circumstances. And so I had nobody to talk to, nobody to ask about it. And he was in the OR with the patient. It scared the bejesus out of me, as it should have. But that was my first experience with Origin Med Systems in the office at 6 a.m., right?
Didn't give you training.
They didn't give me training. But at the end of the day, he figured it out. Everything worked. And that started my career at Origin Med Systems. Fascinating experience.
What did they do? What did they say to convince you to join?
I think I was flattered that they wanted me. I felt I could contribute. One thing that I felt I was good at was execution, rapid execution, unencumbered by intellect or data. I could execute anyway. And I thought that was something that in that environment would be helpful. I also respected the hell out of these guys, right? I mean, I think that respect is very important. And I also listen. And I think that allowed the relationship and the company to move forward. And we were ultimately bought by Eli Lilly and company. And we were then spun out into Guidant Corporation. And I was responsible for two of the five operating units of Guidant. Origin Med Systems and Heart Rhythm Technologies. Mm-hmm. I worked for Ron Dollins, who I adore. I learned a great deal from him. But it was also one of those things where I wasn't going to be a career Eli Lilly, guidance guy, right? I'll never forget Ron, every time he saw me, reminded me of what I left on the table by leaving Guidant, and it was non-trivial. But that was not why I left. And Jay was there, and Jay was, he knew what he was doing, and he did a lot of great things for Guidant, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful to see.
You have another gig up there.
So at that time, I had been teaching at USF, and I thought maybe I'd like to kind of do it full time. And so I went back and got a doctorate degree, and I got over that quickly, the idea of doing teaching full time. I could do it, but I also I could continue with my career. But I wanted to do something different. And so Jay and Fred Rich and David Mooney, they were forming a new venture fund, DeNova Ventures, and they invited me to join them as a partner in March 2003. So I joined them. Mm-hmm. And it was a great experience. It allowed you to operate in multiple specialties, right? I mean, you essentially see the future every day with these young entrepreneurs, and it was wonderful. Wonderful to be involved with them on a daily basis. But I must say, so in one of my classes, they had done a case study on Ioptex. And after class, two students came up and asked my opinion of their idea. And their idea was they wanted to figure a way to straighten teeth without using metal. And if I thought it was interesting, would I help them? And mm-hmm. So I joined them as an advisor, an investor, and a board member, and that became Invisalign, mm-hmm. which was a crazy, crazy story. I mean, it was such a challenging environment. They had so many technical challenges along the way. Mm-hmm. There were material science challenges. There were modeling challenges. How do you determine the force necessary to move teeth using a polymer, right? It was extraordinary, and
When you first hear the idea, do you ever thought it would be where it could be? Do you invest in them because of the technology and the people?
And, the people part of it is very important, obviously. And what they had was an extraordinary amount of passion. But they had not executed in any kind of a startup environment. And so given the breadth of the challenges, material science challenge, computer modeling challenges, all this, that, and the other thing, I thought the idea was interesting enough because, metal has been used forever. It's barbaric. It's metal bending. It's applying force that the orthodontist offered. Oh, my God. The discomfort. There's so many negatives about it. We had been involved with a company. We bought a company from J&J that was an orthodontia, and I was the acting CEO. So I knew something about it. The idea was so exciting that if we could figure a way to pull it off, mm-hmm. it would change orthodontics forever.
Which it did.
All of a sudden, orthodontia is a hot area. You've got Smile Direct. You've got Invisalign, which shipped $2 billion worth of aligners.
So you were there in the beginning.
Yeah, the very beginning,
you helped the company to become where it is. It's like, what were the pitfalls that they faced and how you helped them overcome it, mm-hmm. and what the lesson learned for any young entrepreneurs who has a huge potential.
Right.
And so much to deliver.
Yeah, I think as with so many young companies, they don't hire the best and the brightest, right? They're reluctant to give away a senior title and pay too much money. They'll tend to hire people that they're great, ambitious, young, have a lot to offer. But you need expertise. You need experience. Nothing is greater than experience, right? And it took a long while before we hired the kind of people we needed to hire to manufacture them, mm-hmm. to develop them, to sell them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's one of the real challenges. The second one is sometimes young CEOs don't know what they don't know. And they're not very willing to acknowledge it, right? I think in the entrepreneurial world, how often do we see stories about a founder that ends up getting in the way of the success of a company, right? Because he or she doesn't want to give anything away, wants to assume all control. And it's a tragedy because those founders would be the single biggest beneficiaries of success.
Right.
So why not bring a team around you that increases the probability of that success, right? So I think that was the challenge we had at Invisalign. And I've seen that challenge in multiple situations that I've been involved with as an investor or as a board member, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really unfortunate, and it's really tough to talk people, to change people's thinking on that.
It's growing the pie bigger.
Yeah, I mean, you know, having a little bit of a bigger pie is better than having a really tiny pie, right, at the end of the day. I think that's one of the challenges.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
The second challenge is, how do you manage the money? What do you do with the money? What do you listen to the VC who says, oh, you just got to spend it all and move, first mover advantage, blah, 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 blah. At the end of the day, you're the only person accountable if that's not a good strategy, mm-hmm. right? And all of a sudden, you're at the end of the line money-wise, and there's nobody to point at besides yourself. So you have to manage, I think, your money mm-hmm. very, very carefully. And you have to understand who or what is your most immediate addressable market, all right? One of the challenges at Align was, when you talk about the market, you know, it's easy to say, well, 280 million people have teeth, so that's a big market, right? But you segment that market and sub-segment that market, and you do it as fast as you can, because only then do you have a shot at succeeding. And it turns out, our most immediate addressable market were professional women working who could afford to have braces or a correction. And the correction was very modest, right? Because with disruptive products, and that was a disruptive product, the first generation doesn't always work the way it should, all right? So it has to, you have to iterate and evolve. Mm-hmm. And early on, I think the company tried to appeal to a too broad a market, and that hurt it, and it caused the company to spend a lot of dollars when mm-hmm. they didn't really need to.
Mm-hmm. So I think the team, the founders, eventually do they stay through, or do you need? Sometimes the founders are right for the right stage, and then mm-hmm. another person needs to be bringing
correct,
the product.
Correct. So there were two founders, and First, ended up leaving. The stock, the company had gone public. The stock went from 17 to low single digits. And so he left. The other founder, co-founder, Kelsey Wirth, wonderful woman, she stayed on. She was on the board for many years. And she was the voice of stability. And everybody respected her. And it was good that she was there. It was good that she was there. That's not always the case, mm-hmm. Very often. The founders will reach their point of diminishing returns. And rather than working with the board to come up with a reasonable succession plan, they fight it tooth and nail.
Okay.
And so they end up not being there.
So, I mean, you know, the board definitely is very important when you're an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have a lot of experience sitting on the board and investing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a lot of successful company mm-hmm. under your belt. I mean, mm-hmm. the recent one is Avedro.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then, what's the best way for entrepreneurs to engage with the board? And how do you select your board? Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, the investor, they mm-hmm. always bring their board. But how do you select, say, an independent board?
Right.
And what is the role of independent board?
Right. So it's never too early to have a board. I mean, initially you can call them something else, your advisory board, right, at the end of the day. And the one thing about our community is access. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurs have access to an extraordinary population of really talented people, and those talented people are willing to talk to you, right? So understanding that, if you look at the challenge you've got, and if you look at the investors' makeup, as board members. What are the gaps? What are the skill gaps, right? In many cases, you know, understanding your target market could be a skill gap. Manufacturing, in the case of Invisalign, manufacturing was a huge skill gap. It had never been done before. So you really have to understand where the gaps are and draw up a spec. And the spec has to meet what your needs are. And then go find that person. Too often, it's a name, right? I mean, look at Theranos. Oh, my God.
They have all the big
guns. Oh, my God. They had all the big guns, but none of them matched the spec of what the company needed. And that I think, was a major force in its downfall. That was a tragedy because somebody from the industry would have understood what the challenges were. So it's understanding what your needs are and really drawing up a spec and executing against that spec so that somebody shows up that really understands what the challenge is.
Right. So I think oftentimes when in the startups, you have the board member, they tend to be the major investors, mm-hmm. and then they maybe have one or two independent board.
Right.
And so what is the role for, I think the independent board is important. Like, what is the role of independent board in the company?
Right. To me, the independent board are partners of the chief executive, right? And although they have a fiduciary as an independent board member to the company and to the rest of the board, they are there, I believe, to help that entrepreneur succeed. And it's far more than a quarterly board meeting.
Right.
It's a relationship. It's a commitment of X number of hours. And it's sticking to it. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do that, I don't think you're a value-added board member, mm-hmm. right? And that's a shame because I think there's a bigger role for boards to play than they do play.
Right.
And it's helping that entrepreneur learn and increasing his or her probability of succeeding.
Yeah, I always say that the independent board should be somebody who can mentor you mm-hmm. as an entrepreneur
Absolutely.
And CEO.
Absolutely. It's so valuable. Ray Larkin is a good independent board member. Okay. Mm-hmm. He was the chair of Invisalign. He is maybe still the chair of Invisalign. And he was a partner of senior management. Mm-hmm. And he was there to act as a check and a balance when appropriate, but he was also there to act as a coach, a very senior, seasoned executive coach.
Yeah.
And he performed that very well. He's still performing that very well.
Yeah. So, okay. So I know we've been digressing a lot bit mm-hmm. on that. So with the Invisalign, and then, but since then you have done a lot. I mean, you have covered ophthalmology,
orthodontist
and women's health.
Right.
It's like, so what are, I mean, you have so many different
when you're my age,
variety. some people with your age have not even covered half of what you've done.
But isn't there a common thread, right?
Right.
The common thread is, what kind of a leader are you? What kind of a culture do you set? And what kind of people do you hire? Mm-hmm. It's very, and that applies to everything because everything's about dealing with human beings. And all populations of human beings have their own foibles. Mm-hmm. Dealing with clinicians, imagine that. So it's a matter of what kind of a leader you are, what kind of people you hire, and what is the culture you establish at the company. Right?
Yeah.
And making sure that everybody in the company understands that culture. And holding people accountable. I think one of the challenges in the venture community, nobody who is not doing a good job is ever forced to leave too early. Right?
Yeah.
It's very often it's late and it's unfortunate because it costs a lot of people their investment dollars. Right? Mm-hmm. And it puts all your employees at risk. That's a tragedy.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of responsibility as the leader, and you have to take that responsibility very, very seriously.
So do you think, young entrepreneur when it started, and some have work experience and some have left. And some, this is their the first times they lead. Some of them, even though they never lead, they become a good leader.
Absolutely.
Is this something that can be learned?
Oh, absolutely.
Groomed,
totally. I'll give an example. If you think about John Hennessy, who was the last president at Stanford, if you had met him on the first day he became president of Stanford and the last day he was president of Stanford, it was like two different people. He grew into a great leader, right? He hired fabulous people around him. He allowed them to do their job. He supported them every step of the way, but he held them accountable at the end of the day for producing the kind of results that he expected. So he set a very high standard, and he stuck to it, and he insisted people live up to that. Second example, and unfortunately it's another academic, Alan Garber. Alan Garber is an MD, PhD. He was a healthcare economist at Stanford. And I knew him here, and I had done a fellowship at Harvard, and he is now the provost at Harvard. And if you had seen him as the healthcare researcher at Stanford, and now as the provost at Harvard, he's grown so dramatically, and he's a man of great stature. And it was wonderful to witness that experience. And you see that in CEOs. I mean, some grow and learn, others don't.
So how can you make sure that more people grow rather than grow?
That's your responsibility. That's what you want to happen. You don't go there with the idea that I don't want the CEO to succeed. You want that CEO
right.
to succeed. And I think I try to give the impression as a board member or an investor to that CEO that I'm here for you, I care about you, and you have the skills to make this happen and make this succeed. And if there's anything I can do to help you, I'm here. And I think they test that as soon as they can to see if that's actually true. And I demonstrate that, yeah, I am here for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's kind of like with students. They know if you care about them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can cross that chasm, you will be a good teacher and they will be great students, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. You have to care about the people you're working with.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, I mean, I've worked in a place that I found the culture is really something that I want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And that I've also worked in a place that the culture that I do not want to be in.
Absolutely.
And it makes a huge...
all the difference in the world.
The difference in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think that is something that is coming from the leadership and their personality, what they think,
mm-hmm.
what's important for them
mm-hmm.
rather than the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you change that when somebody's like that already, who happened to be the leader?
Yeah. So I think you hammer them. You hit them on the side of the head. I mean, figuratively. But you have to establish a standard and an expectation. And you've also got to be able to define to them and legitimize what you're saying mm-hmm. as being something that they need to think strongly about.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the results, effort is appreciated, but results count. But at some point, a toxic culture, takes over, right? And an ineffective leader takes over. And an ineffective leader will hit a point of diminishing returns. It happens invariably, okay? And you try to coach that person to perhaps evolve a little bit and think about things a little differently. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah. And then, so as an investor, you do want to find the right entrepreneur, CEO mm-hmm. who can grow because that makes everybody's life mm-hmm. easier too.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when it doesn't, what are the things that you do and how you do it?
Right. So I would tend not to invest if I see a team up there that I don't feel comfortable with, right? And it's not so much their technical skills or anything else, but it's just their behavior, right? They're in the room for an hour, And the founders, whoever shows up, spends most of the hour arguing amongst themselves. That's not a good sign, right? And it's not, the only thing you have is your time, right? It's the only non-recoverable asset you have. So you have to decide how you want to spend it. And so we would tend to not get involved with teams that we weren't comfortable with, right? Then let somebody else, worry about, redirecting a person's entire way of thinking, right? That's really hard.
That's stressful and takes a lot of time.
That's really hard.
Yeah. So you've done a lot of helping a lot of the startup entrepreneurs, and you teach, but you're also pretty active in your doing charity work. Do you want to share more about that?
My biggest philanthropy is Save the Children. Save the Children is quite a large NGO that helps children in crisis throughout the world. It's been here for 100 years, so we all worry about sustainability with our charities. It's been here 100 years. It's very efficient in that it 90 cents of every dollar goes directly to programs, so it's very cost effective. We're data driven. When we do something, when we undertake a program, we measure our impact, measure results. So it does all the right things. And that's something that as we think about what we're interested in, we have to pay attention to sustainability. Second thing, and maybe most important, there's no greater leverage than helping a young child. And if you could direct that person or help influence that person to go into the appropriate direction, the return on that investment is infinite. It really is. So children deserve a shot. And that's why I am a big believer. In fact, I'm having dinner with the president of Save the Children. She's coming in tonight. I took my daughter, Sarah. We were in on the Syrian-Jordanian border. Save the Children helps manage a refugee camp on the Syrian border, 100,000 people. 20,000 of them are children under 10. That's crazy, right? The average family has almost 6 children on average in the house. Unemployment is rampant, especially in a refugee camp. So we manage a so-called safe zone. The safe zone is surrounded by concertina wire and armed guards, but the families can leave their children there, and we have play groups, we have nutrition, health and education, vocational training. Walked into a tent, and there were these young boys shaving an inflated balloon with a straight edge. They were learning how to be barbers, right? And we lecture the moms on what constitutes child abuse, because there is a high degree of child abuse in that part of the world. So those are fabulous. I mean, those are awesome programs. So helping children, one life at a time, it's very satisfying. It's very satisfying.
I found that you're fascinating. You fill your life with so many amazing things. Oh. And you've done so much. Mm-hmm. And you're on the board of so many different companies. And mm-hmm. I feel like you're busy.
Yeah, busy. Right, right. So I should thank my wife, too. With the support, the undying support of my wife, we moved immediately to Los Angeles from Zurich, Switzerland, with very little notice. That was very, very important. I came home. I told her about the opportunity. I told her it required me leaving tomorrow for Los Angeles and that I would meet her there. She took our 2- and 3-year-old daughters, and she went to Los Angeles. And I owe her
less than 24-hour notice.
Yeah, pretty much. I owe her a debt of gratitude, right, for doing that.
It's good to have the right partner.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I really appreciate you spending the time with us and share your story with our community. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from you today.
Oh, you're very kind. This is a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening today, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.